So for today, the plan is fairly modest, actually. I'll start with a review of adiabatic theorem or adiabatic evolution in quantum mechanics and the notion of Berry phase. So I prepared some review on this, but just let me have some idea. Have you seen this in your actual QM course? The previous one? No, okay. Yeah, that's fine. I actually prepared for that. So, right. But if you want to read more, just pick your favorite quantum mechanics textbook: Sakurai, Griffith, even Wikipedia. actually, yeah, this thing is so well established that even Wikipedia page is pretty reliable. Right, and then I'll move on to talk about a little bit of topology and the application of the notion of Berry phase in band theory. For that, if you want to read more, well, there is the pretty reasonably pedagogical review paper by Hassan and King. If you want to really read in some detail, I think there's a book by Bernenweg and Hughes that summarizes a lot of these notions. Okay. All right, let's begin. So let me first talk about adiabatic theorem. So this theorem concerns a slowly changing Hamiltonian. So usually, very often we deal with a time-independent Hamiltonian, but you can ask what happens when it's time-dependent? Right, the parameters are changing over time. Well, generically, things can be a little bit complicated, but there is a regime where things are pretty simple. That is, if the change is slow. Of course, you can ask, slow compared to what? I'll tell you very quickly. So let's say I have a Hamiltonian that's time-dependent in general. And at each time, well, it's just a Hamiltonian, so I can still talk about its eigenvectors and eigenvalues. In particular, at each time, it has eigenvectors or eigenstates psi n. N is the index of the state. Right. And it's time. This is also going to be time dependent because it's an eigenvalue of a time dependent matrix. Eigenvector of a time dependent matrix. And the eigenvalue, of course, I also expect it to be time dependent. Well, the thing is, the eigenvectors of H, or the eigenstates of H, form a complete set. So I can expand anything, any state, in terms of this basis. Okay. So now generically, so that is saying generically, if I have a state, then I can always expand in this basis. It's a time-dependent basis, but it makes sense to expand it. Well, so let me pull out a phase factor, a fairly trivial phase factor here. Okay. So if, for example, if H is time independent, then this is just a number. Then it's the familiar minus IET phase factor. H bar equal to 1, of course. Okay. So this is just pulling out a simple phase factor. So now you can plug this thing into the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, right? You replace this En by h times psi equal to I partial t psi. Right? You just plug it in, and then it becomes a bunch of algebraic equations for Cn. Yeah. You can massage with the algebra a little bit, and then so I won't do the actual massaging for you. So what you get is a set of differential equations for this Cn, these are coefficients. What you get is this, Cn. Essentially, you take the time-dependent Schrodinger equation and then take an inner product with this psi n. Okay. Again, yeah, I encourage you to check the algebra on your own if you haven't seen this before. Okay. So what can we say about this? It looks still pretty complicated.
There's no d inside size expression.
Where?
Inside.
This one?
On the left.
Yeah. Sorry, what?
There should be t's there?
No. It's just e minus e. It's just e m.
And the eigenvectors?
Oh, sorry. You mean, yeah, of course, these are all time dependent. Yes. Virtually every expression here is time dependent. This is also time dependent. Yeah.
Were the exponential thing to pick
up? Sorry? This one?
No. Before. So we expanded any state size.
Yeah. So I'm just pulling out a phase factor. Essentially, I'm redefining C.
Oh, okay.
Because this factor is gonna be not as interesting. So I'm just pulling it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like the Dyson formula.
It's not. It's gonna be related, but not exactly that. Yeah. We don't need that here. All right. So. So in general, it's pretty complicated, especially if I have this summation term. So this runs for all the eigenvectors. So it's in general pretty complicated. But then there is an adiabatic limit. So this means that there is a time scale tau, or let me call 1 over tau the rate. This is the scale where for which the Hamiltonian H changes significantly. Yes, sorry.
What was the step where you got C, del T, Cn? What did you do to get that expression?
Sorry, this one?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, you take the time dependent Schrodinger equation, right?
Okay.
Is there a minus I or I? I even forgot that. I think it's I. Yeah. Yeah. You take this, but then remember this psi you can expand in this basis, and you plug it in. Of course, you get an equation of this ket states, but then you take the inner product with some bra, and then you get this.
Why is this superscript? I don't.
Sorry, wait.
You have partial t c n and the superscript. I cannot see. Is it t?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just saying everything here. You should think of it
as
time dependent.
All right.
Yes.
And that derivative is acting only on the Hamiltonian, right?
Yes. It's more customary to if you see something like this. And actually, let me use that notation. Okay. So there is a time scale tau. That's the time scale over which this Hamiltonian will change significantly, right? So adiabatic limit means that time is very long. Right? So it takes a very long time for my Hamiltonian to change significantly. Well, long compared to what? Well, the statement is it's long compared to em minus em for all m. Let's say we focus on the nth coefficient, so you can. Right. So why is that important? Well, the thing is, you see, here, of course, this thing is time dependent. So the statement is that 1 over tau is smaller than this at any time. Yes?
What do you mean by changes a lot?
For example, the terms in H changes by order 1, or the same order as the original. So there, you know, exactly how you define this may not be unique. You may be off by some factors of like 3, 4, but it doesn't really matter for this kind of argument. In fact, very often we're going to very often people use the argument when this is almost infinite, infinitely small, infinitesimal. All right. So the reason why this simplifies is in this case, this is a strongly oscillating term. So this term is roughly, let's say, e to the I e m minus e n t, roughly. Right. So suppose this has some lower bound. Okay. So it's strongly oscillating. But then within, let's say, some period of tau, this only changed by a little bit, but this is already like oscillating like crazy. Okay. So which means if I go to some reasonably long timescale, this term averages out, drops out. I can just forget about this complicated mess. Okay.
Can you say the argument again, please?
Yeah. This term is oscillating. And this statement is saying the oscillating period is much smaller than tau. Okay. But in a time scale much smaller than tau, this thing has barely changed. So the terms here are controlled. Yeah. So that thing, you can actually compare this term with this term and then see that this term drops out in the sense that it's much smaller. So so what you get now is an extremely simple equation times a number. And this equation is very easy to solve because this is just a number. It's a time-dependent number, but still it's a number. You get Ct, Cnt equal to Cn at time equal to 0 times a phase factor called gamma n. And gamma n is this thing. Let me write out the indices carefully. Okay. So what does this mean? Well, it means that if I started with an eigenstate. For example, then this is telling me that I will remain as an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian at that given time up to a phase factor. Even though my Hamiltonian may have evolved quite a bit, I mean, even though tau is long, I can evolve for a time period much larger than tau. Doesn't really matter, right? Which means, suppose I have some energy level originally, after some time evolution, this level becomes this, this level becomes this, this level becomes this. So if I start from here, I'll end up here, up to a phase factor. Likewise, if I start from here, I'll end up here.
In this period of, one Hamiltonian transit to another Hamiltonian, if the level crossing happens in this period,
this will be violated. So,
is this limit still meaningful?
Then things break down. You can no longer assume. It remains the same. Yeah. So this statement is saying that throughout my evolution, the gap between two adjacent states better not close. They better remain bounded below. And actually, this has a very intuitive understanding. I mean,
the gap might become smaller or bigger, but it can't close.
Yeah, it better not close. As long as it doesn't close, you can always make tau large enough that this thing makes sense.
Okay, so it will close if we pass the limit when 1 over tau is much smaller than
delta. The statement is if it closed, that means at some point of time, En minus Em is zero. So there is no tau you can choose to make that condition satisfied. Well, okay, so what does that really, I mean, intuitively, how do I think about it? Well, intuitively, it's actually very simple, because this 1 over tau, by uncertainty principle, gives you an uncertainty in energy when you evolve the system in a time-dependent way, okay? So if this uncertainty in energy is much smaller than the difference in energy, then you don't expect this small uncertainty to create a jump from this state to this state, for example. But if the opposite is true, then you expect this uncertainty to cause you a lot of mixing between different states, right? So it's really just time energy uncertainty principle in operation. Yes?
I'm sorry, I think I got confused. Are you saying that if we vary adiabatically a Hamiltonian, the gap never closes?
No. I'm saying if you adiabatically evolve it and if the gap never closes.
Okay. What happens if you have crossings?
If you have crossing, this thing breaks down.
Right.
You should actually go back and think about what to do.
Is there nothing in the formalism that tells us when we have a crossing and when we have
Okay. In general, you have to honestly solve the time evolution problem. For example, that equation is still true.
Okay.
Now you can, for example, include another term.
Okay.
Right, and then see what happens.
Because you're dealing with degeneracy.
Yes. So there are things you can do. It's not just as simple.
Thank you.
And in fact, we may see something even like that in the case of phase transitions of integer quantum Hall effect. Well, I don't know if I'll get there, but let's see. All right, so that's the adiabatic theorem. It says it's saying if you move very slowly, you're not moving. Oh, in different space, of course. Okay. Right. The other thing is this phase factor gamma n. Let me put it down. This has a name. It's called the Barrett phase, and it's sometimes also called geometric phase. So you say, okay, why is this a big deal? Well, in general, it's not a big deal because this phase is not, usually it's not very meaningful. Why? Well, for one thing, so if I do a gauge transform, right, I have a time-dependent state. So I have the freedom at any instant of time to redefine it by a phase factor. Right. Where alpha t is any function of time. You'll see that this phase factor changes. Essentially, you'll see that this gamma n changes to gamma n. I think plus alpha t minus alpha 0. Just plug this in here. Okay. So in general, this phase factor is not well defined. It depends on which phase convention I'm choosing for my state. Unless I evolve in such a way that at the final time, the two states are the same. Or in a better way, the Hamiltonian evolves evolves back to the original form. So the two states are basically the same. They can differ at most by a phase factor. Now these two phases cancel out. And then gamma is gauging variant. If this reminds you of what you learned in electromagnetism or electrodynamics, you're on the right track. Okay.
Right.
Yes.
Why we return to the same Hamiltonian? The alpha phase cancel out.
Remember, yeah, this. Okay. The statement is okay. I should be a little bit more careful. The statement is this phase factor acts on the Hilbert space. So if these two states are genuinely different, there's nothing to forbid me from redefining one state by a phase factor, not the other, or redefining them by different phase factor. But if they are the same, when I redefine the state by a phase factor, I have to do the same phase factor on both of them. So which means that if this is true, then I must have alpha t equal to alpha 0. All right, so now let me comment a little bit about what we can gain from this adiabatic theorem. It's especially in many-body physics, or even just in band theory. Right? The statement is that different many-body, we can say that for even single-body, but it's less profound. Many-body states, for example, a field band, if you like, that are connected by adiabatic evolution can be considered similar. Even though the states themselves may look very different. Remember, this is not, I'm not doing perturbation theory. I'm not saying after evolution, the final Hamiltonian looks, exactly looks very close or very similar to the original Hamiltonian. I'm not saying that. I'm saying as long as such a path exists, right? Which could include cases where HT is very different from H0, but still I consider the states similar. And sometimes states that cannot be connected adiabatically this way are considered different phases of matter. For many people, that's the operational definition of phase of matter. Even though one has to be a little bit careful. A case where one doesn't have to be that careful is when the states are gapped. Because gap states remain gapped under adiabatic evolution. Remember, gap states in our case basically means insulator in the context of band theory. Yes?
Why did you want to perform the gauge transformation?
I'm just saying I always have the freedom to do that. Right, you give me a bunch of states. You call them up and down. I say, I don't like that. I call up, I call down e to the I pi down. That's also a perfectly legal set of states. And my physics better not change. Anything physically interesting better not change under that relabeling. So this is saying, in general, this gamma n changes under relabeling, unless it's a closed path. The evolution is a closed path.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So gauge transform is really just a fancy way to say relabeling. It's in general quite true, even in actual gauge theory. Yeah. Okay. So gap phases remain gap under adiabatic evolution. That's almost by definition, because if it doesn't remain gapped, the evolution is not adiabatic, because as I said, the gap closes. Yes.
So it is not going to be like gauge invariant if we have closed curves.
Yes.
Sorry. Like in general, we're going to have gauge invariants, right? But you said that when you have like closed curves, then we don't have gauge invariants.
No. When you have closed curves, that gamma n is gauge invariant quantity.
So for closed curves, we're going to have gauge invariants.
Yeah, and which means for closed curves, gamma n is going to be interesting.
Okay.
For open curves, it's not going to be as interesting. Yes.
I don't quite understand the meaning of many body states. Like,
take a field band.
So, are these independent or are these interacting?
They could be anything.
But
since we've only covered band theory so far, so take a field band. But that statement is true even for interacting states. So let me actually show you a concrete example to illustrate what I mean by that. Okay. Let me go back to, again, the simplest example, type binding model in one dimension. Yes.
Sorry. So you can actually do a global gauge transformation, then gamma will always be global gauge invariant. So in that case, is gamma interesting?
Sorry, what do you mean by global?
It's just like no t there, e to the bar I alpha is just simple.
Oh yeah, if you restrict the kind of transform you can do, yeah, then, but the thing is, in this context, it's that restriction is not so justified. Unless psi happen to be the same all the throughout the this. In general, of course, you can make that statement, right? It's invariant under global gauge transform. But here, as long as it's not invariant under local gauge transform, it already feels less interesting. It's not gauge invariant, that's the statement. Right, okay, let's look at the example. Hopefully your favorite band structure, type binding in one dimension. Okay. Do you remember last Thursday, I talked about a band structure where you have nearest neighbor hopping plus a staggered chemical potential, an on-site potential that takes up plus minus form. Right? So let's revisit that a little bit. Essentially, it's all, I'm not going to say anything new, but view it from a different angle. So I have the hopping term, and then I have the staggered potential term, which looks like this. Okay. So there are two limits where you can solve this quite easily. I mean, it's the whole thing is pretty straightforwardly solvable. But let's look at two limits. One is if delta is much larger than t, then you diagonalize the delta term first, right? And again, the rule is you fill all the energy levels that are negative, the fermion levels that are negative energy, and leave all the positive energies empty. So the ground state looks like having all the even size, which let's say delta is positive, everything is positive. Then having all the even sides filled, so you have one occupation number one, and having all the odd sides empty. So it has this very simple real space picture, which is having one state filled, the other one empty, the other one filled, empty, and so on. Right, so that's an insulator you have. Now you introduce a little bit of T that these days wiggles a little bit, but the overall picture doesn't change. Of course, there's the other limit, which is delta much smaller than T. And then you can solve the band structure. Even within provision theory, you can see that, let's say this is minus pi, this is pi over 2, minus pi over 2. So the band structure will look something like this, where you have a gap of order delta. If you remember that. Yeah. Of course, in both cases, they are insulators. One with a gap, one with a large gap, the other one with a pretty small gap. But then the statement is, if I adiabatically evolve my Hamiltonian, I've already used T here. So any suggestion on what letter to use for time?
Tau.
Yeah, I've used a tau there, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay. Yeah, whatever. So let's take a time evolution. Let's say at tau equal to 0, let's say delta is, 100 t, for example. At tau equal to some later time t, capital T, that's very large, let's say much larger than 1 over t or 1 over tau, or delta, doesn't really matter. Delta is, let's say, 0.1 t, something like that. You get the idea. And one can actually check explicitly, because this is such a simple model, that the gap never closes. Right? It's always gap. So that's what we mean when we say these two states are adiabatically connected to each other.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that argument that you made there with the diagram.
Sorry, which diagram?
This graph is T and tau and so on.
This one? Or?
Yeah, that one.
Sorry, this one or this one?
That one, the second one.
This? Oh yeah. No. Here I'm just saying you turn on a time dependence to evolve your Hamiltonian from this limit to this limit. For example, you make delta a function of time. And initially you start with this limit, and then you end up with this. I'm saying as you evolve throughout, as long as your delta doesn't go to 0, which in this case it doesn't have to, the gap never closes. So as long as you evolve slowly enough, this insulator will evolve to this insulator. Even though, for example, if you look at the wave function, they're going to be very different. Yes.
They're adiabatically connected, therefore.
Yes. Sorry, is there a question?
Yeah. When you say that like this insulator will evolve to this one, like what, could you present them in different ways? I don't have a good idea of like what you mean by what the second one is evolving to. Like,
sorry, but you mean this statement? Or,
yeah.
So the statement is, I'm not proving that for you. I'm just telling you the result, which makes intuitive sense. That's suppose I have a time evolution. In this case, you can just take it to be linear. For tau, plus tau over t, for example, delta t minus delta 0. Right? Take a delta that depends on time in this way, so that at tau equal to 0, you take the initial value of tau equal to capital T, it becomes this thing. And then you say this, you take your delta 0 to be huge, or you can do it either way. Let's say you take your delta 0 to be much larger than T, and take your delta capital T to be much smaller than T, but non-zero. Okay. Saying as long as this capital T is large enough, then you can find a T large enough that takes you from this wave function to this. Yeah, so they are considered adiabatically connected. Yes?
I think maybe it would help if you drew what the bands would look like in the complete.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, maybe that's helpful. So you can solve similarly a band structure like this in this limit. What you will see is this. In the same coordinate, it looks like this, with a gap of order, the gap is of order delta. Yeah. So the insulator is again a field band, except it looks, locally actually looks very different. Yeah, a general statement is if the if in this type binding model, if it's very close to this kind of limit where particles literally just sit on some sides and not really moving, the band is you expect to be flat because the derivative is like a velocity. So flat band means it has no velocity, it's not moving. And this limit is sometimes called the atomic limit. Right, it's like you literally have some atoms or just electrons just sitting on the atoms. Or this kind of insulator is also known as atomic insulator.
We could also say that the excitations or something are infinitely massive. Would that make sense to say?
It doesn't have to be infinitely massive. Right. It's in this case it's delta.
Yeah.
For example, you can go to it doesn't have to be delta large, it can be T small. Take T equal to zero in this case. Right.
But in terms of looking at it in terms of a dispersion, like the one on the right, the delta small, you can feed it up on the right.
This one?
The small delta. The parabolic dispersion for small k, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, the naive inertial mass diverges. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So so this line of thinking is actually extremely powerful. You can think about much more complicated cases this way. So let me just comment. You will see much more non-trivial examples later, later in the course. So it's often useful, almost always, but let me just say often, to view a complicated state as an adiabatic deformation of something much simpler. Of some simpler state. For example, this insulator, we say it's the adiabatic deformation of this simple picture. And yeah.
How do we decide whether it is possible to, so if you take two arbitrary systems and whether they can be adiabatically connected or not, how do you actually get to decide?
Welcome to the land of topological phases of matter. So that's the entire subject, which is what I'm going to touch upon a little bit next. But the general answer is it's usually very hard. Because in this case, let's say I just throw at you this statement. I'm saying, take this evolution, it's going to be adiabatic. If you don't believe it, you're welcome to solve this model. It's a pretty simple free-form type binding model, so you can actually see it for yourself. But there are much more complicated cases where we don't actually know how to solve the model. Then it becomes a much more delicate question. Okay. And if all this sounds like topology to you, you're on the right track. Topology, you ask questions like take a shape, deform it a little bit, by obey some rule, does it somehow continue to some other shape? Right. It's actually very similar. Of course, that connection is better established, as I said, if the state is gapped. For gapless, it's actually a little bit more subtle. But we'll see an example of gapless case later. But for now, let's focus on the gap case. Things are simpler, simply because a gap state remains gapped if you do adiabatic evolution. Okay, so now you can ask a simple question. The question is, can we always adiabatically deform an insulator or a gap state, an insulator? To an atomic limit. The atomic limit means literally just in real space, some particles sitting on some sites, not moving. Okay? So it's kind of the boring kind of insulator. If you want to imagine something, some insulator where electrons don't move, that's how you imagine things. The question is, are all insulators boring? Okay? So see, this question sounds very familiar if you have seen some topology. And the answer is no, not always. And when such adiabatic deformation to atomic limit doesn't exist, we call the phases a topological phase of matter. Okay, that's an entire subject. So before we actually begin, before I actually tell you an example, a prototypical example of this kind of thing, I need to say more about Berry phase and how you apply them to the specific case of band theory. So let's take a break, and I'll do that in 5 minutes.
So when you do this adiabatic deformation, do you expect all the symmetries in the system to remain symmetries?
There are rules you can specify. So very often we want to preserve some symmetries, but there are rules you can specify. You know, you want to say HT, do you require that it to be symmetric under some symmetry throughout the world? I mean, that's a rule you can specify on your own, and different specification gives you different results and so on. So, yeah.
So you have to put it in by hand. You cannot expect that you do an adiabatic deformation.
The thing is, you have to define what you mean by adiabatic deformation there. Is it a symmetric one? Do you not care about symmetry? They're all different, right? Because just saying adiabatic deformation is extremely non-unique, right? You can do it a zillion ways. You can certainly have a 2D insulator where the, for example, at half filling, where the electrons only sit on this kind of sites.
Yes, it is. So is it like a preferred state energetically or?
Yeah, for example, take a staggered chemical potential, right? Negative potential here, positive potential here, and very weak hopping. This is what you get. Yeah.
The two regimes, the atomic limit and the other one, the gaps are both proportional to delta. The deltas are very different.
So. Yes, yes, yes.
But non-zero.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so I require that it never vanishes. Yeah.
Did you get it small enough? Did you get it small enough that would turn it into like a semiconductor?
Yeah, a semiconductor is a insulator with a small gap.
Right.
Of course, the slightly tricky thing is if this is very small, then you require the capital T to be very large.
Okay.
Essentially, capital T, let's say 1 over T, you want it to be smaller than the minimum of the gap throughout. In this case, it's monotonically decreasing. So essentially, you want it to be much smaller than the final delta. So if you make final delta very small, that's fine, as long as you take this capital T to be very large. And then from that, you can see that if delta at T is literally zero, you have some problem. Yeah.
Why do we want to deform to that limit particularly?
It's simple.
Okay.
I mean, Of course, this thing is also simple enough that you don't have to do it that way.
Any general integer.
Yeah, generically, you want to start from a simple thing.
So what you said about semiconductors, semiconductor is a different phase of matter, is it right?
It's an insulator with a gap that's somewhat small. That's basically what. I mean.
Yeah.
Think the statement is if I take a band insulator with a gap that's smaller than something like 4 eV, people start to call it insulator. So it's a pretty arbitrary notation.
Okay, so you did say that if two states are connected adiabatically, then it means they belong to the same phase.
More or less.
So is there can you say a bit more on that?
Well, it means there's sort of a continuity there.
It does kind of intuitively make sense, but it's not very rigorous.
Well, the thing is, what do you mean by phase matter, right? And
the idea of a phase transition is also.
Yeah, the you can because phase of matter, the notion of phase of matter is a notion of continuity. You have to define continuity somehow. You want to say you change your Hamiltonian. In this way and that way, the states qualitatively look more or less the same. Then you say they are the same phase. How do you make that precise? You make that precise by having a precise definition of continuity and deformation, like people do in topology. In this case, adiabatic continuity is the most obvious notion of continuity you can make of. Of course, there are complicated cases, for example, in gapless phases and so on, where that becomes more and more subtle. So it's the gap phase that it's the most straightforward one. Yes.
This gauge invariance, I'm still a little confused. Alpha is a global phase.
The thing is, as long as maybe this notation is a little bit confusing because it feels like it's a function of t. It's really a function of psi n. For any psi n, remember at different time, psi n is a different vector. For any psi n, you can separately rotate it by a phase vector.
But don't relative phases matter?
Not really. Let's say
I have a superposition of two energy eigenstates.
Yeah, that means you take a different coefficient of. This is not doing active phase rotation. This is just redefining vector, right? Remember in the definition of Hilbert space, means okay, we say states live on Hilbert space. That's a lie. States live on the rays of Hilbert space. Yes. So at different state can always be rotated by some phase vector. That shouldn't change anything physical.
I'm so confused how to solve that with lightning. It's just a simple two-state system.
Yes.
And I took an expectation value.
Yeah, that operation won't change any expectation value because this operation will. Man, if you do it right, you realize that doesn't change any expectation.
So in principle, alpha has an n-index.
Sorry. Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
What is the equivalent here?
Yeah. This thing turned out to be the integral of the connection. Yeah. That's the thing I'm going to do next. All right, let's resume. All right, let me go back to the berry phase. Okay. And let's say we reparametrize things a little bit. We say that the time dependence on the Hamiltonian is done through several parameters. You can always do that. For example, these are the coefficients of the terms that depend on time, for example. A bunch of parameters, lambda. Essentially, you view this lambda as a space. So let me write in the vector notation.
Okay.
So now, look at that gamma. Let me suppress the index n. Let me just focus on one state, for example. Let's say ground state. Actually, no, I'll do more than ground state later. But, recall that it looks like this. So now all the explicit dependence are on lambda, and then lambda depends on time reverse. On time. So now you can rewrite this.
Professor, I'm so sorry. I cannot see. Can you write bigger? Is that okay?
You want to write bigger?
A little bit.
Oh yeah, okay, sure.
Thank you so much. I'm so sorry.
No. It could have been the dust background. yeah, let's let me see if I can do better.
I'm so sorry.
No. It's feel free to let me know if any of you also have these issues. So very phase. And let me assume that the time dependence is done through these parameters. Is that better?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so now let me look at the gamma, right? As I said, it's this thing. Now the explicit time dependence is only on this lambdas, so I can, you know, essentially, I mean, chain rule is psi lambda I psi d lambda I. right? I mean, of course, technically it's d lambda I dt and then dt integral over dt, but that becomes integral over d lambda I. So now I can write this more abstractly. Let me decide to give this number a name. The name I give is to is call it A I. And then this becomes integral A dot d lambda. Okay. So now if I again think about gauge transform. Remember I defined as psi lambda is e to the minus I alpha lambda psi lambda. Okay. By the way, this is a better parameterization than that one, because this you see that if lambda are the same, phi should be the same. Yes?
Shouldn't there be a lambda dot?
I don't know. I've done a jump. It should be this dt, but then it's equivalent to an integration in lambda. Yeah. So if I do such a gauge transform, what do I get? Well, just plug in this expression of A, you see that this A goes to A plus essentially partial lambda alpha. This should look familiar. This is what you get for a gauge transform in a vector potential in electromagnetism. Okay. So that's why this thing has a name. It's called, well, okay. This A field, you can view it as a vector potential. In the lambda space, and it has a name. It's known as Berry connection. Differential geometry, a vector potential is basically a connection. So this thing is called Berry connection. And of course, the Berry phase, if it's a closed loop, now you see why this is not gauge invariant. If it's an open loop, if it's an open loop, an open line, then the integral of A is not gauge invariant, because A is not gauge invariant, basically. But if it's a closed loop, this thing, by Stokes' theorem, measures some kind of magnetic flux through the surface enclosed by that loop. And that's supposed to be gauge invariant. Okay. Oh, by the way, have you learned how gauge field looks like in quantum mechanics? Like I partial minus A, that kind of thing.
Yeah. We can assume not.
I say both yes and no. Anyway, let me briefly review. Okay, this will be a really brief review, but if you're not familiar with how gauge field, basically electromagnetic field works in quantum mechanics, you can read a book like, say, Sakurai has a pretty good section on that. I think even Griffith has that. I'm going to do a very simple thing called Aharonov-Bohm effect. It's basically saying the gauge connection, I mean the vector, the electromagnetic vector potential, you can in some sense, really view it as some kind of Berry connection. Right. So the statement is this. So let me take a simple setup. Let's say if I have a region with a magnetic field going out of the plane, let's say. But it's the field is only non-zero inside this compact region. And suppose I have a wall bounding this region so that particles can't get in, right? And now let's say I shoot a particle, it can go this way, it can go this way. Let's say I take your favorite double slit experiment or something, right? So you get some interference pattern on the wall, and you can do it many ways, right? But the statement is, okay, given that the particles can't get into this region, does the magnetic field has any effect? Right? If you think classically, there's no effect because it never sees the B field. But here, the statement is, if I move through this path or through this path, there's a different Berry phase. Right? The difference in this gamma, when a particle moves from through this two path, it's going to be, let's call this path R1, let's call this path R2. Okay, so R1 A dot dr minus A dot dr in R2. Right, essentially, you view the electromagnetic vector potential as the Berry connection. Yes?
Sorry, what's the ball?
Sorry, so this is, let's say, if I'm in 3D, this is like a magnetic flux tube.
Okay.
So the magnetic flux is, the field is going out of plane. Right, it's a tube. Or you can also think of it as a 2D. So then magnetic field goes this way. Right, so that's the difference in the Berry phase. But now, R1, R2 by themselves are open loops, but the difference is like a closed loop. So now this thing becomes the closed loop of R1 minus R2 A dr. But by Stokes' theorem, this is the same as the B integral. Ds is the area within this area, this part. So it's the total magnetic flux enclosed. So this will have an effect because it says that when this path and this path interfere, there's a phase shift. That means if I have no magnetic field, I get some interference pattern here. But now I gradually turn on some magnetic flux here, and the interference pattern will shift because of this phase shift. Right? Even though the particle never actually saw the magnetic field. So that's known as a Aharonov-Bohm effect. I mean, there are many different representations, but yes.
Stupid question, but does that not bring translations and variance of space?
So oh yeah, it does. So what? We live with that. Momentum is no longer a good conserved number, but you can talk about states. You can talk about interference. There's no problem.
In some other reference frame, I'll see that magnetic field as an electric field, right? So.
Or in some other reference frame, you can that produces an electric field. Yes.
Does the same thing happen there, like in different reference frames?
Not through the electric field. I mean,
essentially, the question is
no.
Delta gamma is this dependent upon the observer?
May. Well, if you do Gaussian boost, it's not going to change. I'm less certain about Lorentz boost. Let me not say anything for sure. Yeah, I think Gaussian boost is okay. Because you don't change the magnetic field, you just change the electric field. Electric field doesn't directly give you this. Well, okay, actually, there are examples where electric field gives you analogous phase shift in some setting. So let me be careful and not say too much. I'm not entirely sure. Yeah. Okay, so So that's your AB phase shift. Let me call this AB. The other curious feature is that this is periodic because this is a phase factor. So if that phi is 2 pi, it doesn't do anything. Yes?
This A you're using there, is this the vector of potential for electromagnetism?
Yes.
So what's the relationship between this and the A previously defined as the derivative of the quantum state with respect to the vector parameter lambda?
Yeah, so the connection is not entirely straightforward. So the better way to say that is if I have a continuous set of states, when I move from one to the other, right, I have to specify, you know, in the language of geometry, I have to specify some notion of parallel transport. Right? I have to say I go from one state to the other, there could be some phase accumulated. Right, so how do I define that phase? And that requires to introduce the definition of connection there, the U1 connection there. So in that sense, these two both come from that angle. Okay. So but you can say that if I somehow imagine a Hamiltonian, yeah, okay, this is probably a better way to another way to say it. So imagine a Hamiltonian where the particles, the ground state of that Hamiltonian is this particle just wiggling in a little box around some site, around some place. And now I gradually time evolve that Hamiltonian to change this box, the position of that box. Right? So that becomes the problem of adiabatic evolution. And then I can talk about Barrett phase. And it turns out to be the same as this electromagnetic gauge connection. Oh yeah, so good. One thing I forgot to mention is once I actually write it this way, you see that the time dependence dropped out. Only the lambda dependence survives. That means this part of the phase does not actually depend on exactly how fast or how slowly I evolve. Right? Even though I need to assume that I have to evolve slowly to make everything better defined, this phase factor ended up only depend on the actual path I evolve, I sweep through in the parameter space. So that's why it's called geometric phase. It doesn't really rely on the dynamics. Sure. Okay. And similar here. So in a real experiment, this phase is not the only factor. Right? In an adiabatic evolution, this phase factor is pretty much the only non-trivial thing you can ever observe. But for example, in this double slit experiment, you're not doing adiabatic evolution. That's why it may look confusing at first sight. But the statement is this phase factor will come in on top of a rather complicated process. Let's say you have some interference here and there. But this phase factor will nevertheless be there, precisely because it doesn't really depend on the dynamics. The shorter summary is even for non-adiabatic process, this phase may be there. It just the effect of it will be subtler. Okay, so that's a crash course on how this electromagnetic gauge connection enters in quantum mechanics. Let me finish. So this number is defined this phase factor is defined mod 2 pi, which means if I have a non-trivial magnetic flux that differ by 2 pi. Or let's say I just have a magnetic flux of phi 0 equal to 2 pi. So in the actual unit, if I actually put back my h bar and so on, I think it's let me get the unit right. Yeah, it's hc over e is the electron charge. Okay, so if I have this much of flux in this tube, then nothing happens. It's as if I have no flux, right? Because gamma would be 2 pi. So this is known as a flux quanta. Okay, so this will be important later. In fact, essentially, at some integer phi zero, this Berry phase effect disappears.
Sir, I'm thinking phi zero equals to 2 pi times the factor h.
No, 2 pi equal to this number because h bar equal to 1. H is 2 pi h bar, remember. So it's really 2 pi h bar c over e. So that's what I mean. All right, so okay, now let's finally get back to solids or band theory. What does all this mean?
There's a maximum phase factor involved. It cannot go more than a certain phase. Because
2 pi, you mean?
Yeah, because phi naught is like 2 pi is the maximum, because you go more
than... No. Phi can take any value. But this gamma is defined only mod 2 pi, because it's a phase factor. Yeah. But I'm not saying phi cannot go beyond this. Yeah. I'm just saying when phi go beyond this, only the fractional part matters, as long as this... phase factor is necessary. And in fact, you can solve the spectrum. For example, I think there's a nice exercise on Sakurai that's saying if I have a cylinder and I have a particle moving on this cylinder and I have a magnetic flux within this cylinder, you can solve for the spectrum. I mean, essentially the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian, just a kinetic term, but minimally coupled to a gauge field, you realize that in general, the spectrum looks different from a zero field case, unless this phi turns out to be, happen to be an integer times this phi naught. Then you get exactly the same spectrum. Okay, so By the way, I just want to get an idea. Are this helpful or these are already very familiar?
It's helpful.
It is? Okay. At least in the old days, meaning my time, quantum mechanics class usually covers something like that, but maybe not anymore. All right, so let me talk about Berry phase in band theory. So what do I do? Well, essentially, that lambda thing I've been talking about, let me take that to be the lattice momentum within a Brillouin zone. Essentially, my this thing I've been talking about is basically the Bloch state at the n now being the band level of a momentum, at some momentum. So what do I want to think about? Well, I want to think about let me say I have a Brillouin zone. Let me just for simplicity draw a square one. And I have some particle at some lattice momentum k. Now I imagine somehow turning the Hamiltonian in such a way that this k starts moving. This electron will move in the Brillouin zone in some fashion. Okay. And suppose it moves slowly enough so that there's no interband transition. Let me assume the band structure looks like this. So there is a clear gap separating all the different bands, so that if the electron moves slowly enough, there's no transition from, let's say, here to here. Okay, so this is forbidden.
Is this electron like in the convection band, or does it have to be?
Could be anything. This is, at this level, I'm doing single particle physics. It doesn't really matter. Okay. So now this is a perfect example where you can talk about all those things. So now let's talk about this. So now let me be more explicit. So consider a time-dependent Bloch state. Let me just call it K. If you like, you can call it UKP using a Bloch wave function, but it doesn't really matter. Just do it. Let me just use this notation. Okay. I've already suppressed the band index. Let me assume that this particle only moves within one band. Okay. So now I can talk about, okay, it moves like this, there is a Berry phase. E to the I mean, it's gamma. Suppose it moves in a closed path, then it's given by this k, I partial k, k, dk. Okay, I'm just copying the formula there. And again, let me define this thing to be A, but now it lives in K. So this is just A dot K. Okay, and that's just copy pasting. But now let's do 2D. So let's restrict the space dimension to be 2. Let's say I'm doing graphene or something like that, right? Now by Stokes' theorem, I get this thing, right? It's the surface integral of the curl. So let me give this thing another name. Let me call it little b. So this is b, the surface integral of b, integrated over the surface enclosed by the path. Okay. So this B has a name. It's called Berry curvature.
Sir, is it partial over what? Partial over B x?
Sorry?
A partial times I. Time
partial time. Cross oh. A. Yeah, sorry. The curl. Of course, if A is the analog of the vector potential, then B is, of course, the analog of magnetic field. So essentially, you want to view B as a magnetic field in momentum space. Right. The usual magnetic field lives in real space. This one lives in momentum space. So okay, now you ask, what's the effect of that thing? Right, the effect of, for example, real magnetic field is give you some Hausdorff Bohm type of phase factor. What is the momentum space one? Well, of course, you can talk about a Hausdorff Bohm phase-like thing. For example, take it around a loop, and there is a phase factor that may show up in some interference type of thing, but
this part is not visible.
Oh, well, that part's not visible?
Could you do something with the board?
No, that's the thing. This part doesn't move.
The stand.
Sorry, what?
Oh,
this one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Better? Does it work?
Sorry.
No. I mean, yeah, okay. All right. Let's see. Well, yeah, there's a limit.
Two pi.
Sorry, what?
Two pi limit.
I mean, does it work? I can rewrite it if you want. You can see it? Okay. All right. Okay. So yeah, you can do some, you can imagine some interference type of thing, but there's a more drastic effect. For that, let's go back and think. Let me make a, let me derive a result by drawing a simple analog. It's not going to be rigorous, but it can be made more rigorous. You can consult some more serious reference, for example, the one I listed at the beginning, for a rigorous derivation. But for now, let me just give you a extremely hand-waving but physically sensible one. Okay. So. So let me begin with a reminder that in real space, a magnetic field, let me call it B, modifies the equation of motion. Right? So in the following way, let me write down the Hamiltonian equation of motion. Let me actually write down a semi-classical. I mean, the Hamiltonian equation of motion, you can convert that to a quantum mechanical one. But let me just write down the classical, semi-classical one. Essentially, I'm going to go back to the semi-classical, almost Newtonish type of thing we did last Friday. Okay. So in real space, what happens is this. So x dot is partial h. Partial p. And p dot is minus partial h, but let me say the h here meaning b equal to 0 over partial x. Now this is the usual force term. But now if I have a magnetic field, I have the Lorentz force. I should include that. So the way you include that is to say, there is a term x dot cross b. Okay. So now we want the effect of magnetic field in momentum space. Well, what's the difference between momentum and coordinate anyway? Right. There's nothing to forbid you from treating k as coordinate. But now, minus x is now momentum. Quantum mechanically, you can see this by noticing that the thing that the relation that defines what you mean by coordinate and what you mean by momentum is the canonical quantization rule. IH bar equal to this thing. But of course, you will also have this relation. Right? So this relation means enables you to call x coordinate and p momentum, which of course also enables you to call p your coordinate and minus x, your momentum. So if you have now a magnetic field in momentum space, then you just, let's say we decide to call momentum coordinate, what do we get? Well, now k dot is partial h, partial minus x, and minus x dot, because minus x is not the new momentum, is I think minus partial h, again b equal to 0, partial k plus k dot cross the magnetic field in momentum space. Of course, here I'm assuming the magnetic field in real space is 0. So if it's still non-zero, I actually have another term. You can write it actually more symmetrically in this way. In this way, you get a magnetic field in both momentum space and real space. But let's not do that. Let's just say I have just a magnetic field in momentum space. So here's your equation of motion. Now, this looks slightly different from the semi-classical equation of motion we had last Friday, but it's a sensible equation. Let's solve it. You don't really have to solve it. You just do a little bit of massaging, then you realize what that means for you. Okay. What does that mean? Well, it's first of all, let me say that the spatial dependence of H is given entirely by electric field, E. Right? That's what we had. Well, that's what we did last Friday. Let me take the little E. The unit charge should be one. So this is just Newton's law. So what is this? Well, partial H, partial K is the partial energy, partial K. That's the velocity. That's the standard velocity. Right, so now this equation, now let me take the minus sign, be like this. So now this equation becomes the standard partial C K partial K plus, sorry, did I screw up some signs? X dot. Yeah, I think that's fine. Yeah. Okay. Also, let me take the simplest case. Let me take no scattering. So remember before we had to worry about some, you know, 1 over tau v term here. So let's take the simplest case. Let's take tau to be infinite. So no scattering, the simplest Newtonian one. And then K dot is just E, right? So now this goes to CK, the normal, the usual kind of velocity. Let me just call it VK. Plus E cross B. So what happened is compared with before, in the velocity, this X dot is velocity. In the velocity term, I get an extra thing like this. This is also known as anomalous velocity.
How does the minus become plus?
Sorry. K dot is E, right?
Minus.
Yeah. Somehow I have a plus sign here. Did I just screw up some sign here?
In the partial h with respect to k,
yeah,
there is a minus and it should be a plus because you changed the sign.
Okay, let me do it slowly. Minus k plus x dot. I think this is correct, right?
Yeah, but when you change the sign, you need to change the sign
on the sorry, I change sign here, and this becomes minus, right? What's wrong?
Yeah,
it's probably right. Anyway, you're welcome to check the signs yourself. It's just classical equation of motion. I think that sign is correct. All right, so what does this mean? Well, you now have an extra velocity. That means you now have an extra current. Because now you have remember, current is density times velocity. Right. So beside the usual one, let me just figure out the current from this extra term, because the older term we've done last Friday. Okay. So the current you actually now have is given by, let's say again in 2D. Why is it? Can you even see what I'm writing?
It's a little
faint. Very, very faint.
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing it. What's going on? Okay. Maybe I should just press it harder. Better? Delta J. Okay. Just before should be an integral times the distribution function, you remember, times this thing. Right? But let's say in 2D this B is in the Z direction, in the third imaginary direction. So you can rewrite it as in 2D, essentially B is BZ. So now you write it as E cross Z. There might be a minus sign. So what does it mean? Now you're writing component. And also let's take, just for simplicity, take F to be F0. Also take the zero temperature expression, which is it's a theta in minus CK. Right, so it's 1 if K is negative and 0 if it's positive. So that means I get something like this. B, K. Epsilon ij, ej. I may have made this sign mistake here and there, but I remember this one is correct. So if any sign goes wrong, this is the correct answer.
What is the definition of epsilon?
Epsilon ij are the component of this matrix. It's the anti-symmetric tensor in 2D. Yes?
I'm just realizing that's J subscript I, right? Not 2.
Yeah. Oh, this is I.
Component.
This is I. J is sum, of course. Right? So, what does that mean? It means JX. So let me call this number sigma XY. It means JX is sigma XY. EY, JY is minus sigma XY EX. It's Hall conductance or Hall conductivity. For example, you shoot an electric field in Y direction, you get a current in the X. And sometimes this is known, also called anomalous Hall conductivity. Because the Hall conductivity or the Hall phenomenon you saw probably in high school or freshman year, that comes from a magnetic field. Right? You have a piece of metal, you put in a magnetic field, and then the particles will bend because of Lorentz force, and then you balance the Lorentz force, and then you get some voltage in the transverse direction if you shoot a current. Right? So it comes from Lorentz force. This thing doesn't come from Lorentz force. If anything, it comes from Lorentz force in momentum space. Okay? That's why it's called anomalous. So you can have a scenario where there's no magnetic field applied at all, but you still get that kind of Hall conductivity. So now an even weirder thing before we end.
So here, the B is basically by curvature.
Yes. Now even a weirder thing, because remember last time when we did the Boltzmann transport, one of the conclusions was that you get a non-trivial conductivity only if you are a metal, right? Only if you have some partially filled band. You get expressions like, you know, sigma proportional to the density of state at, you know, at c equal to zero times some v, v, stuff like that. The thing is, this number is zero if I have an insulator, if I have a totally filled band. Right? So from last time, if I have a totally filled band, the result, the conductivity has to be trivial. But now with this extra term, with this extra anomalous velocity or anomalous current, now let's revisit that. Suppose I have a totally filled band. Totally filled band means this number is just one throughout the entire Brillouin zone. And by the way, for totally filled band, I expect sigma xx to be zero. Remember, this contribution is only always transverse. The current I get is always perpendicular to the electric field applied. Okay. So totally filled band for sigma xx, what we said last Friday still applies. So you expect to be zero. Let's say I'm at omega equal to zero, or omega smaller than the gap. All right. But now you look at that expression. That tells you sigma xy for a totally filled band or an insulator is something like d2k 2 pi square bk. Looks like it doesn't have to be zero. So may not be zero, even though it's an insulator. And there's nothing contradictory, because this is a non-dissipative response. Right? This epsilon tensor guarantees that the current you get will always be perpendicular to the electric field. So your ohmic dissipation, E dot J, will always be zero. So it's consistent with the fact that it's a gap, there's nothing really interesting happening at low energy, but it doesn't have to be zero. Okay? And when it's non-zero, it's known as a chain insulator or integer quantum Hall effect. And next time, I will show you that even though it may be non-zero, it has to be, let's see, h 2 pi. Times an integer. So wait, is it 2 pi or 1 over 2 pi? I think 1 over 2 pi times. Yes. So that's next time. All right, so we'll end here.